Thanks. Well, this is this talk is going to be 90% Blackboard talk. I thought that would hopefully work well for this topic. It gives people a chance to really ask questions, and I don't have tons of results with fancy view graphs anyway. So let me just get started. Now, then I'll have some results to show with the view graphs. But we have RG methods for quantum chemistry. First, I want to set the stage a little bit just by saying what I mean by quantum chemistry, which is basically the electronic structure of small molecules. And then there are two main topics. The first is applying the density matrix renormalization group method, DMRG, to this quantum chemistry problem. And then the second is a method which I'll call canonical diagonalization. It's a unitary transformation approach. And we'll also apply this to quantum chemistry. And the most interesting part of this is when you combine these two methods. So the hybrid canonical diagonalization, DMRG. It turns out that these two methods are very complementary. And so you get a very powerful approach when you combine the two. Okay, and I'll try to say also a little bit later on, I'll try to say where is, you know, why am I interested in this? Where am I trying to go with this? It relates to problems, hard problems in strongly correlated systems where we need to develop models for the systems in a more systematic way than we've done in the past. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about small molecules, say the water molecule, and I'll give some examples of the water molecule. That's an easy test case where one can do the equivalent of Langshoff's exact diagonalization, then compare methods and see how well you're doing. And then I'll show at least one view graph with some results for the chromium dimer, which is for these sorts of small molecules is one of the very, very most difficult. The quantum chemists have struggled with the chromium dimer for a long time. So one is interested often in calculations involving total energies, usually total energy differences. So for instance, one might want a potential curve for a diatomic dissociating or the extra electron affinity for putting an electron on a molecule. One is interested in these differences in energies to rather high accuracy. The correlation energy is typically in these small systems of order 1 Hartree. And one atomic unit, so that's 27.2 electron volts. In order to get what they call chemical accuracy, you want on the order of a few millihartree. Okay, and so the correlation energy is what you get. It's the error in the Hartree-Fock. And so in effect, you want to do better than Hartree-Fock by a factor of some hundreds. And so it's a difficult problem just from the point of view of getting the energies so accurately. But that's what you need to do to compare to experiments. You can say this is a tenth of an EV. Okay, now these calculations in the traditional chemistry fashion start with a basis. It's usually made out of Gaussian functions that are centered on each atom. And one of the things about this is that if they tie the basis functions to each atom, so that if the atoms move around in the molecule, you don't have any anomalous terms from the core electrons overlapping differently with different basis functions being at different locations. So you get some nice cancellation of errors there. The typical number of basis functions might be of order 100, sometimes less, sometimes more. So you put these basis functions on the atoms, and you do Hartree-Fock as the starting point for almost all these methods. Okay, Hartree-Fock does a very good job for the core electrons. The total energies are, say, in the hundreds or thousands of Hartrees, and so this gets the vast bulk of that very nicely. But this is normally just considered a starting point, and then you try to go beyond that. But you start with the Hartree-Fock because that gives you the starting point, and it gives you a nice single particle basis to work with. And so once you've done the Hartree-Fock, what's normally done is you transform to a basis where you have orthogonal Hartree-Fock orbitals, and you can write the Hamiltonian in this standard many-body fashion. Okay, so we have the kinetic energy term, and also put into this is the energy of the Coulomb energy of the electrons with the nuclei, and then you have the interaction term. Okay, so we have at the end of this a many-body Hamiltonian, and you can think of it, if you're used to strongly correlated models, you can think of this as a very messy generalized Hubbard model. It's got the same Hilbert space, and it's got the U term in here, but it's got also n to the fourth other terms added in. And so it's actually useful to think of it this way from the DMRG point of view. Yes, well, I mean, there's a big difference between, say, a Hubbard model with a U, and then you add in a few more terms, and then here you've got all the n to the fourth terms.
Body theorists that work so much on the Hubbard models, they've forgotten this is the usual form.
No, I'll say more about. I'll say some more about. One of the main goals I want to have is to try to start with this sort of ab initio approach and reduce it down to some sort of simple Hubbard-like model with a modest number of terms, but to do it in a systematic way. Okay, so let me say, since some people may not be familiar with DMRG, let me show you one of my standard quick view graphs for DMRG. Okay, the DMRG is a numerical method based on Wilson's renormalization group approach that he used for the Kondo impurity problem. The basic philosophy is to solve a many-body system a little bit at a time. So if you focus down here, thinking about solving a system, where think about solving a one-dimensional system where we have lots of sites, and we make a block with lots of sites in it. The basic approach that Wilson developed was to diagonalize the Hamiltonian of this block in order to get an effective Hamiltonian. And the way you represent that effective Hamiltonian is by keeping a limited number of states, for this block, throwing away most of the Hilbert space but keeping a limited number of states, and keeping a fixed finite number of those states so that you can keep adding on more degrees of freedom to it without ever increasing the size of the calculation. Now, if the system has, the Hamiltonian has a certain structure with the energies sort of in an organized arrangement, this can work very well as Wilson developed it. When you apply it for something like a Hubbard model, it works very poorly. And the density matrix renormalization group is a way of fixing that. The main difference between Wilson's approach and DMRG is that instead of taking to form your effective Hamiltonian for the block, instead of taking the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, you take the eigenstates of a reduced density matrix of the system that actually comes from the wave function of the entire lattice. And in doing this, it turns out that you can show that these density matrix eigenstates are optimal, the optimal states to keep. And it turns out for one-dimensional systems, this they work extremely well. You have to do a complicated iterative procedure, though, because it's sort of a chicken and the egg problem. In order to know what states to keep for the block, you need to know the entire wave function for the entire system, but you don't know that until you've done the block. Okay, so the way you solve these sorts of chicken and egg problems is numerically, is usually you do them iteratively. So you start with some sort of approximation to these blocks, and then you systematically improve them. And so the DMR iteration involves dividing the system into two blocks, one a regular block and one the environment block, and you move the boundary between the two blocks back and forth, which in a set of sweeps, which builds in the self-consistency. Okay, and this works extremely well for 1D problems. You know, it's not so hard to get energies with, say, 10 digits of accuracy for 100 site systems. One can go on and apply it to two-dimensional systems, but that gets harder. I don't want to go into this now. But the main point here is that DMRG is set up optimally for a one-dimensional system. And it likes to have the interactions as local as possible, preferably just between nearest neighbors. Okay, so that's a little bit on DMRG. Well, in two dimensions, you start with very high accuracy in one dimension, and then what we tend to do is make slightly wider systems and increase the width until we lose too much accuracy. And so it's just a question of how wide you want to go with your current numerical technology. So for we can get reasonable results, qualitative mostly results. Well, I shouldn't say qualitative, but we get reasonable results with, say, the truncation errors of 10 to the minus 4 up to width 8 in TJ models, and it just scales down. That's the accuracy is considerably improved in narrower systems. Okay, now let's go back to thinking about applying this for this very messy Hamiltonian. Its Hilbert space is the same as the Hubbard model, so I can look at it as a set of orbitals, which Hartree Fock has arranged in some order of energy. And I can just lay them down and get a lattice. Okay, and you can apply DMRG to this system with this Hamiltonian. And in fact, when I first did this, I didn't really have to change very much of my DMRG program. DMRG program works on a wide variety of Hamiltonians. And mostly I just had to change the input so that it read in all of these terms and formed this, it formed sort of a Mathematica-like representation of the Hamiltonian, had to read all those in, and then it could just go to work. Let's see, let me say I'll say a little bit later about choices of the ordering of these orbitals, because you can lay them down in different ways. It's energy ordering is just one way. So that actually worked, just sort of doing without change, putting this into DMRG. The problem was that it was computationally very inefficient. And the reason is that you have, if there are n basis functions, they're n to the fourth terms. And when you go through the process of the exact diagonalization to get the wave function at each stage, you have to put in all of these terms. And so it's sort of a factor of n to the fourth slower than an ordinary DMRG calculation. It turns out that there's a nice trick for reducing this down that improves things by a factor of n squared. The problem is very slow. Okay, so there's a trick which was first developed in the context of a DMRG approach for in momentum space. But there's a trick for grouping together operators. If we look at all these operators, let's focus on the ones that start with, say, C dagger 1 up, C dagger 2 up. Okay, so there are of order n squared operators like this, say, C L up, C K up. There are of order n squared operators like this, each with their own coefficient, V 1 2 L K. And what you can do is lump them together. You can pull this out and write C dagger 1 up, C dagger 2 up, and then put all the rest with a sum on L and K, V 1 2 L K, C L up, C K up. And so we define this to be a complementary operator, which I'll just call O 1 2. Okay, so before you start doing any diagonalization, now these LKs, I've specifically chosen 1 and 2 to belong to the left block. And L and K are going to go over the right block.
But this may also coincide with 1 and 2, yeah?
What?
L and K, and maybe also 1, 2.
No. So here's one.
But suppose you can say four variables.
But you're right, so, wrong distance.
Oh, yes, there are other terms there are other terms which are easier to handle, and I don't have to do this. If suppose L and K are both in the left-hand block. If they're both in the left-hand block, even the ordinary DMRG program would have already added them into one operator, the block Hamiltonian. So if everything's in one block, it's just absorbed into a block Hamiltonian. This is what makes ordinary DMRG so efficient. If you have a one-dimensional system with nearest neighbor interactions, you can have incredibly strong interactions within the block, but the only things that you have to really worry about are the things connecting the two blocks. So there's just a few terms that you have to worry about. The rest is absorbed into H block. Okay, so.
Just a question.
Yeah.
Do you start from a specific orderings of the Hartree-Fock orbital?
Yeah. So imagine that it's just the energy ordering at this point. I'll say more about that in just a minute.
Maybe one more general question, Jeff, to better understand what you're doing. Hartree-Fock is actually one slice of determinant. And so, are you going to finally obtain something like one slice of determinant, but which much better wave functions and energies, or you're going beyond
Okay, what I'm using Hartree-Fock for, I mean, you do the Hartree-Fock and you get an energy out, but what I'm mainly using it for is to when you do Hartree-Fock, you can think of it as just a Slater determinant of the orbitals which are fully occupied. Okay. But in the procedure that the chemists normally use, you actually have, you're diagonalizing a Fock matrix, and it gives you a complete set of single particle orbitals that are arranged in energy. And so I'm viewing this as a nice change of basis, a single particle change of basis, so that I can write down a Hamiltonian like this, where a lot of the work is already done. It's in a within this sort of changes of single particle basis, this is in a nicely diagonal form, but not fully diagonal, and so the whole point of this is to go beyond.
So can I ask you, so the I's and J's, are they the Hartree-Fock eigenstates or the sites? So they are the Hartree-Fock?
Yes, that's same thing.
Same thing.
Orbitals and sites are identical, and so I'll use them interchangeably without noticing. Okay, but now, so here I'm thinking of them as sort of orbitals, single particle orbitals, but down here I think of them as sites,
but
exactly
practice,
the same.
In practice, they are Hartree-Fock in this. They are the band index of the Hartree-Fock orbitals, right?
Yes. Yes.
And if you have n basis functions, you have n solutions, that means you have n energies, which you then take on your sites.
Well, sometimes I'll be talking about many body energies, and sometimes I'll be talking about single particle energies. Here I'm talking about single particle levels, and so there are n of them.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Yeah, of course there's 4 to the n many body
right.
states, and
right.
that's what I'm,
but at the
you
moment
know,
you're still on this n
yeah,
thing, right?
Right. Okay, so the problem is just organizing the calculation. Yeah, okay, good. Now this is why it's nice to have the...
So are these energies the eigenstates of the first half of the Hamiltonian?
No, it's not. It includes this, but with the restriction that it's a single Slater determinant. Okay, so you...
Okay, it's the Hartree-Fock treatment of that Hamiltonian.
Yeah, it's, think of it as a mean field treatment of...
Okay.
Of this.
Yeah.
But it means that in this thing that there is maybe an 8-0, that has been diagonalized, yes? I mean, in part, these E's that you have some... Mm-hmm. Well, now I got confused again. I thought I understood that to go from this one-dimensional G thing here, you now use the energy, some kind of Hartree-Fock energy, as your one-dimension, your way of ordering things.
Right. So...
The first question comes in, what is, are these energies? Are
okay, let me describe it in a slightly different way. Okay, so here's a picture which should look very familiar. We've got a Fermi level. We've filled up the lower occupied levels, and the ones above are empty. Now, when I'm talking about Hartree-Fock purely, then these are fully occupied and these are empty. And then what the whole... Yeah. Now, what I want to do with DMRG is then take this Hamiltonian, but remove the restriction of double occupancy, and so that it's gonna smear out, and so I'm gonna have to deal with a many-body wave function. Okay. Okay. So I was talking about this trick for reducing the amount of work dealing with all of these terms. And what you get from this trick is a reduction by a factor of n squared in the amount of work, because you've lumped n squared operators together into one operator. It's the complementary operator to this pair of operators. So this lives on the left block. This lives on the right block, but its indices are on the left block. That's why it's complementary. And so it's what gives you this factor of n squared. So all of a sudden the calculations are much more feasible.
But is this sort of kind of a mean field treatment, a sort of flux? I mean, this looks a little bit like the potential that these other electrons are seeing, and then we're planning on changing that.
Well, in principle an exact. You think I don't know where what your background is. From a chemistry point of view, you'd say this is a full CI type of approach. It's a diagonalization of all of the degrees of freedom. So you're going to allow this to each of these orbitals to be empty, have a single up or down electron, or be doubly occupied, and you're going to systematically go through and diagonalize the whole system, putting in everything. But since that problem grows exponentially large, you do this many-body truncation procedure as you go through the system that involves the many-body density matrix. It selects out representative many-body states, which are very complicated combinations of simple states, that configurations, and it makes this optimal many-body basis, which is used to essentially get a full CI result for the system. However, there is an approximation involved, and there's the approximation involves in that you keep a certain number of states in the system, which we usually call little m. This is the number of states per block. Now, in something like a one-dimensional Hubbard model or spin system, the accuracy of the calculation goes exponentially with m. And so we can get extremely high accuracy with m of order 50 or 100. For these more complicated systems with these longer range interactions, it falls more slowly, but we still control the accuracy of the calculation with this number m. And as m becomes very large, it becomes an exact calculation within this basis.
Steve, you made another approximation. You told us that YJKL are all in the block. That's okay. There's one more set of terms, obviously. Three of them are in the block. And the
yeah.
Okay. Just throw those terms away?
Oh, no. Okay, so I've told you how I deal with the most computationally intensive term. Okay, you do the same thing if three are in the block and one not. You do a complementary operator for this guy. So you do an OL that comes from summing over all combinations of three guys on the left and adding in the appropriate Vs. And so this actually becomes a sort of negligible part of the calculation, because since it only has one index, you've reduced it to an order N piece instead of an order N squared. Okay, so all the terms are accounted for, and I just sort of talked about the messiest ones here. Okay, any more questions before I show you some results from this?
How many is this decomposition? So there are a lot of
terms. it's of order a dozen.
Ten.
Yeah.
I mean, in simple words, what you call block, for that you basically do something which in the accuracy would be like a CI calculation. It's just that you do it in a different way. Is that a simple way to?
Yeah, you can think of it that way. Yeah. Okay, so let me show you some results for a water molecule. So we have a water molecule with 25 basis functions, and the exact results have been done by a quantum chemistry group some years ago. So we have this energy that we'd like to reach. It's not the exact energy for a water molecule. It's the exact energy within this particular basis. And converging on the number of basis functions is sort of a separate issue. Okay, but. So here's the Hartree-Fock energy. Here's the exact energy. And so this is the correlation energy, 6 eV. And then I've also shown one of the simpler quantum chemistry methods, configuration interaction containing all single and double excitations. And so that gives you this energy. It's a variational energy, so this will always be above the exact energy. Now, on the x-axis, we have the number of states that I keep in a block, m. This controls the accuracy of the calculation, but of course, the calculation time grows with m. And so you can see that we have sort of a nice convergence towards the exact results. And of course, we'd like to see this blown up. So that's the next one.
Why can you have more states than basis functions?
Because these are many-body states. Yeah, so think of 4 to the 25. That would be the maximum M you could have. Okay. This is blown up. So the Hartree-Fock energy was at 84.84, way up above the ceiling. And here's this configuration interaction with singles and doubles. Here is a multi-reference configuration interaction. So it starts with a small diagonalization of a small part of the system and then does excitations above that. And this is one of the best quantum chemistry approaches. Then they can also estimate the error in that and throw in this estimate of the error, which usually improves the results, but it's not variational anymore. And so that's this result down here. So the DMRG is converging, it's converging rapidly. It's a little bit hard to characterize exactly how it converges, perhaps exponentially, but it's converging rather nicely to an answer which is, you know, easily within the sort of accuracies that we'd like.
So the exact thing, how do you
know? Well, it's only 25, so it's 4 to the 25. You do the equivalent of a big Langshow's calculation and you get, and so this is, you know, sort of the state of the art 10 years ago to get these benchmarks that people could compare with.
Is there any Compton Monte Carlo calculation for this kind of?
Well, this is in a basis. And so there's certainly Green's function Monte Carlo calculations for the water molecule, but that would be not in a basis. And so we wouldn't be able to compare these numbers at all. Because it doesn't have a basis, it would be shooting for a much lower energy that's not basis set limited than it would have error bars. And so it's not a good thing to compare with. But certainly there's Green's function Monte Carlo results.
It should be also possible to use this basis and do Monte Carlo as treated as lattice, like what you're doing here, right?
Rather little has been done on that. It tends to have a severe sign problem. Let me finish. There's a recent preprint by Xiwei Zhang that talks about progress in constraining the propagation of the determinantal quantum Monte Carlo method. And so that's just a month or so old. And he's coming here in...
He canceled.
Oh, okay. That's too bad. He has a very interesting new calculation that is exactly like you described, working within a basis, doing the determinantal sort of Monte Carlo with a method to deal with the sign problem.
How do you do with determinantal Monte Carlo with these sort of interactions?
You do a Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation to break these up, and what?
Continuous field.
I think it's discrete. I'm not sure. No.
You
can do it. No, you can. Continuous. Yeah. You just have more fields. I think so. I think you can take each term.
Where you want to teach us?
Oh, okay. I worked that out. 10 years ago, I think, and I think you can do it, but. Okay, but
when you say 4 to the 25 or 4 to the n, of course that's grand canonical. I mean, that's
yeah.
Arbitrary number.
Okay, so reduce it by a factor of 1,000 or 1,000,000 or something. Yeah. Just to get the idea across. Because we don't actually, the quantum chemists, of course, employ all the symmetry tricks and whatever can be done, they use to. Do these benchmark calculations. Okay. Oh, and I didn't quite finish. Xiwei is working with a complex Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation, and he's found out a reasonable way to constrain that so that you don't get this horrible phase problem, which when I played around with this stuff, it was always much, much worse than the sign problem.
Complex
phase,
yes.
Okay. Let me show you one more result from this sort of calculation. This is the water molecule, but where you stretch the two OH bonds to double their equilibrium length. And the point of this is that in the ordinary water molecule, the Hartree-Fock does a reasonable job. But when you move the hydrogens out, Hartree-Fock does a bad job. And so most of the quantum chemistry techniques have severe difficulties because the Hartree-Fock starting point is not very good. Okay, but we really aren't dependent on Hartree-Fock here. It's just giving us a convenient basis, and and we can use other bases just as well. But our convergence with this system is still extremely good. It's actually a little bit better than the equilibrium convergence. It does quite well. So this, I think this CI result is probably quite a bit higher in energy off than for the equilibrium model. Okay. Now, there, just to illustrate this point a little bit more, the lights. You don't have to use this basis. This comes from the Hartree-Fock, the single particle basis. You can use any basis, and the Hartree-Fock basis is not at all necessarily optimal. It's good, but there are these orbitals called the natural orbitals. What you do is you write down a Green's function, which I'll call rho ij equals c dagger I cj in whatever basis you're in. And this is an expectation value within the exact ground state. So you don't have this at the beginning of a calculation, but maybe you can get it later on. You diagonalize this. The chemists call these density matrices. And you diagonalize it, and you get some eigenvectors. And those are the natural orbitals. Okay, now they're usually reasonably close to the Hartree-Fock orbitals, but in strongly interacting cases, they can be very different. You characterize them by their occupancy within the ground state. So now you have Ni, just the occupancy of the natural orbitals, which for an occupied orbital could be at maximum 2, lowest would be 0, and you put them in order, and they'll look something like a smeared out Fermi function, like this. Okay. So we don't think of this energy ordering, we think of this occupancy. And you can look at the diagonal piece of the energy for this from the Fock matrix, but it's not necessarily even in order. Okay. This guarantees the fastest convergence for configuration interaction calculations. And so it's a nice basis to use. It's a nice basis to use for DMRG. But the problem with it is that to get the basis, you need to have done the calculation. Okay. So it calls out for an iterative method. So you start with Hartree-Fock, and you get an approximate Green's function. You diagonalize it, and you repeat. Now, the other issue is that the ordering of the orbitals, which here I assumed was in order of energy, that's an arbitrary choice. What you'd really like to do is look at the matrix elements in the Hamiltonian which connect different orbitals, and you'd like to put those close together, because when the system sweeps through breaking up things, you want as few broken connections as possible. You want things absorbed into the block, because when it's absorbed in the block, it's done and you don't have to do any calculations with it. So what you'd like to do is sort these orbitals so that all of the strong connections are preferably nearest neighbor or as close together as possible. And so in the calculations that I showed, these were sorted in a reasonable way, partially by hand, but then the answers that you get, the accuracy that you get, not the final answer, but the accuracy of your answer depends on what ordering you choose. Okay, now a nice way of doing the ordering with the natural orbitals is to do it by the distance from half occupancy. It's sort of like going away in energy, away from the Fermi energy. It turns out it's useful to put the ones closest to the Fermi energy first and do the others later. So you would do like 1, 2, 3, etc. Do these ones that are nearly fully occupied or nearly empty at the end.
So this occupation function, you update that. I mean, the step function and Hartree-Fock. Yes. And then
yes. You do the calculation and you calculate it, and it's approximate. but then you use it to improve your calculation. Mm-hmm. So you can do this iteratively. The point about starting with these is that these are the hardest ones. And it turns out that it's computationally more efficient to do the hardest ones at one end or the other. If you put them together, they will interact strongly and you'll get good convergence. So the main problem is getting the whole thing to converge. So let me show you a result where this is done iteratively, which is one of the very hardest calculations I've done. And it'll also give you a little hint of the second part of the talk. Okay, so now this is a big hard problem, at least in this field. This chromium dimer, this calculation starts out with 112 basis functions. Hartree-Fock is done, and then the ones farthest from the Fermi energy, in fact more than 20 Hartrees away from the Fermi energy, are just eliminated completely. If they're occupied, they're frozen. If they're unoccupied, they're thrown away. This gives you 82 basis functions, which are at least a little bit closer to the Fermi level. And then the subject of the second part of the talk, the canonical diagonalization method, that's done to eliminate 44 of the orbitals to get down to 46. And what that does is it throws away all the orbitals which are outside of two Hartrees from the Fermi energy. And it does this in a systematic way, which I'll describe. Okay, then the DMRG takes over. So this is a hybrid CD-DMRG method. The first calculation was just in the Hartree-Fock basis, and it's rather crude. But if you look at the energies for this system, it's really got a very large near degeneracy of about 30 different orbitals very close together. And so the Hartree-Fock is actually sort of semi-meaningless as a starting point here. And so this is one calculation in the Hartree-Fock basis. The next calculation here is done in the approximate natural orbitals from this calculation. And then this is repeated several times. And you don't just stop when you think you get near the right energy. You stop when the natural orbitals stop changing. Okay. Now, this is not... I could show you much. This is sort of the most challenging system that I've come across. I just happened to make this plot for this one. And you can't really see that it's really nicely converged. On other ones, which I don't have plots of, you can see that it stops changing. It just goes back, and the orbitals have converged. And you can tell that you have nice energies.
Of the calculations.
Okay, so
you can't see them.
Well, okay, so yeah, there's dots here at the kinks. This is the number of states that you keep per block, and so I'm increasing the size of the calculation as I go. So the calculation starts here, and I increase the calculation, and so these are all the final energies for the calculation. And some of them I didn't run very long, just because I knew it was a bad starting point. The last one I ran for a good while.
Can I ask you about this number of orbitals? Just get feeling for what this 46 means.
Yeah.
So as a condensed matter person, I would say, well, there are 5D orbitals and an S, that's uh-huh. 6. Now, well, maybe you add 3Ps, that's a little bit more. Then you start adding some core states, then you add some polarization functions and whatever.
Yeah.
Is that the way it goes?
Yeah, right. So this has, the starting basis has one F orbital per atom. And then, I don't know, 4 or 5 Ds or something. So certainly people have used bigger bases for this problem. It is sort of a problem that's been focused on because it's so hard to get the potential at all reasonable. This molecule, some of the early calculations for this molecule predicted a equilibrium separation that's twice its actual value. So it's a real tough case. Okay. So the lights. Okay, let me go on to the... Okay, so what are the weaknesses of this approach? The weaknesses of the approach is that when you have a lot of orbitals, the calculation bogs down, and it bogs down in a way that seems avoidable. When you order the orbitals like this and you go through them systematically, it treats every orbital on the same footing. And some of them are tightly bound core orbitals and some of them are very excited. And you know that the effect of those orbitals is, should be treatable by perturbation theory. Okay, but DMRG doesn't have a good way of doing that. It's some sort of easier treatment on some of them and a full DMRG treatment on the strongly interacting ones. And so it's inefficient. And so one would like to have a method which gets rid of these high and low-lying orbitals and gives you a smaller, strongly interacting system to work with. And one would like to do this, one would like to have a technique that does this sort of thing, not just for these quantum chemistry problems, but in general. If we think about having some sort of appropriate model for, say, the cuprates, okay, people write down the Hubbard model, the TJ model, and then we have to argue about whether those models are appropriate, whether they have all the terms that they need, or whether we're leaving some out. And so we put some in, and we do the calculations again, and we see if it makes a difference. Well, what we're finding out now from calculations of, say, the TJ model is that some of these other terms that usually aren't put in do make a big difference. And so it makes the problem harder to deal with because you have uncertainty about whether the model's adequate. So sort of my long-range goal for this type of project is to develop a more systematic technique of deriving models that have a small number of degrees of freedom from ab initio calculations. And I know that there's been work by probably some people here, I know Gabby's worked on it, on improving density functional calculations with putting in U-terms. So I would like to develop something that's more systematic so that you can think of integrating out all the orbitals that are eventually going to be gone and derive directly an effective Hamiltonian, which just has a limited number of degrees of freedom. Okay, so this canonical diagonalization approach is an approach that has a lot of promise for doing that. It's based on unitary transformations of the many-body Hamiltonian, and it's closely related to work by Franz Wegener and others. I'll talk about it in a slightly different viewpoint than other people have looked at it. These canonical transformations have been used in some form since the 1930s, and things like the Schrieffer-Wolf transformation are based on these sorts of canonical transformations. The difference in the viewpoint that I'll have for the canonical transformation is that they're going to be iterative. So when you do, say, something like the Schrieffer-Wolf transformation, you do it once to go from one model to another. And then you stop and you just focus on that model, which you still have to do a lot of work to solve. I'm going to be focusing on methods that you iterate to try to, you can either try to iterate them all the way to a good approximation to the ground state, or you can go part way and get some nice effective model, but it's always many steps. Okay, now the way I first thought about this was as a generalization of a numerical method for diagonalizing matrices. This is the Jacobi method. So we have some matrix, and we'd like to diagonalize it. And so we're going to diagonalize it by a sequence of, well, I'll imagine everything's real, so I'll make it orthogonal transformations. So we're going to go H prime equals U inverse. And we're going to get an H prime which has the same eigenvalues but has different structure of the matrix and also different eigenvectors. Now the Jacobi method is a very simple method where you try to eliminate one off-diagonal element at a time. So let's consider first a 2x2 case. A, B, B, C. Okay, we have a 2x2 matrix and we'd like to find the U that diagonalizes this. Well, the answer is U equals cosine theta, sine theta, minus sine theta. And the theta is given by 1/2 inverse tangent of 2 hij over ei minus ej. Okay, so if you calculate this theta, form this matrix, and do this, you will diagonalize this matrix where I've written it in the obvious fashion. This is H. So H11 is A, etc. Another way of writing this, which is sort of useful for our purposes, is that this matrix U is equal to the exponential of a matrix A. And this matrix A is actually 0, theta, minus theta, 0. When you exponentiate this matrix, the matrix with minus 1 and 1 here is sort of isomorphic to the square root of minus 1. And when you exponentiate it, it's like using the Euler formula, and you get these cosines and sines. Now, the relevance of this is that whenever you exponentiate an anti-symmetric matrix, you get an orthogonal matrix, or exponentiate an anti-Hermitian matrix, you get a unitary matrix. And so when we apply this to a many-body Hamiltonian, we know that the matrix that we're applying is exactly unitary as long as we start with some anti-symmetric matrix and exponentiate it. Now, the Jacobi method, we start with usually the largest off-diagonal elements, and we apply this transformation, and it zeroes out those elements, and it makes changes in the corresponding rows and columns. And then we look for the current largest off-diagonal element, and we do that one, and we iterate until you have zeros everywhere. Now, you have to go more than once through the matrix, because when you zero some of them, you lose the fact that other ones have already been zeroed. Okay, so the Jacobi method is a very simple method, it turns out that it can be generalized to a many-body Hamiltonian. So the first question we need to ask is, what is the diagonal? When you do this, you get rid of the off-diagonal elements of the matrix and you leave the diagonal ones. Okay, yeah.
In the formula for theta, what is E?
So that's the A and the C.
Oh,
the diagonal ones, yeah, H-I-I, H-I-J. Okay, so first of all, what are the diagonal elements that we're not going to try to remove? Well, the diagonal elements is anything with which is its own Hermitian conjugate. So they call the term H, H dagger equals H. So these can all be written as in terms of density operators, N, I, and J. These are all the density terms are diagonal terms, and we're not going to try to remove those. We want to remove the other ones. So anything that's different from its Hermitian conjugate is an off-diagonal element, and we can try to remove that. Okay, now we're going to construct an A, and you notice it's got this minus sign here, and so suppose we wanted to remove C dagger I, I'll leave off the spin indices, CJ, CK, CL. So call this term V. We're going to construct an A and put a coefficient little a in front of it. We're going to construct an A, which is an A times, let's just make it a theta of C dagger I, C dagger J, CK, CL, minus its Hermitian conjugate, C dagger L, C dagger K, CJ, CI. Okay, so by inspection, this is anti-Hermitian. Do the Hermitian conjugate, and the minus sign comes in. And so if we write down the exponential of A, it's unitary. So what we're going to do is we would look through the off-diagonal elements of a many-body Hamiltonian to look for large off-diagonal terms, and we would apply this unitary transformation to the many-body Hamiltonian. So you're keeping track of the Hamiltonian in some sort of form like this, and you can think of this as sort of a Mathematica type of operation where you're just keeping an abstract representation of the Hamiltonian elements. And we're going to do this transformation, and what's really going to happen is that the VIJKLs will be affected by this. Okay, but it will also introduce terms which involve more than just two particles. Okay, now in order to perform the transformation, it's useful to use this formula, which has been around for a very long time. Okay, so we have a systematic expansion for the terms from this unitary transformation. You have to take commutators, and it converges very nicely. You have the factorials, and then normally the coefficients in A tend to be small, so this usually converges in three or four terms. A lot of analytic work has been done just keeping, say, one term. Okay, but we're going to think of doing lots of terms to achieve a specified accuracy. Now, when you do this, when you do the commutators of the terms, you're commuting many-body terms like this with other many-body terms that appear in the Hamiltonian. And in order to get a non-zero commutator, you essentially have to get a contraction from a term over here with a term over here. So you can see if you have at least one contraction, then you could get terms with six C daggers and C's, or in other words, a three-body term. So the number of terms, the maximum number of terms you get, or the number of particles involved in a term, is if we have, say, an N-body term in one and an M-body term in the other, then we get at least one contraction. We have to subtract one. Okay, so call this N prime. Okay, now if you're doing a rotation that involves only single particle terms, then say N is one, you subtract one, you don't change the number of particles involved in a term. Okay, when you do Hartree-Fock, you can view it as this sort of rotation, where you're doing rotations only with one particle terms, and you don't introduce any three particle terms. So there's no loss of information in doing Hartree-Fock, even though you're not getting three body terms because they're just not generated. But as soon as you try to deal with the interacting part of the Hamiltonian here, this V term, you're going to introduce first three particle terms, and in higher order, you'll introduce terms of much higher order. Okay. And so we have to truncate this procedure, and the simplest sort of thing is to just throw away three particle terms and above. Okay, so the essential approximation that I'll be making is that whenever a three particle term is generated by this transformation, I'm going to throw it away. Now, for a strongly interacting system, if I tried to do this directly on a Hubbard model, it wouldn't work because of the strong interaction. This sort of thing generates would generate lots of 3 and 4 and more particle terms. But if you're considering the simpler problem of you've got lots of orbitals with the Fermi surface in the middle, and you're trying to get rid of these and these, okay, then the coefficients that will come in, the thetas, will be small, and the effect of these three body terms will be quite small. And so I'll show you results for that, but it works quite well. Okay. Now it turns out that it's useful before you start this to do a particle hole transformation so that all of the occupied orbitals are transformed with a C goes to D dagger and the reverse. For energies below the Fermi level. When you do that, if you do this transformation on this Hartree-Fock Hamiltonian, which I'll take as the starting point, one of the things it introduces is a constant term in the Hamiltonian. You end up with an E0, which is actually the Hartree-Fock energy, and then you have D dagger D terms. And you also get terms that appear not to conserve the number of particles. So you get other terms that look like d dagger plus the Hermitian conjugates, etc. Okay, doing the particle hole transformation, if the term has only one of its terms below the Fermi level, then you can get some sort of term like this. Okay, now when you do this, you can sort of redraw this diagram and it's sort of more appropriate to draw it like this. So here we have this E0, this EHF. And in terms of this language, whenever you do an excitation, you're going up in energy. Okay. And when we do these transformations, we're sitting there with the Hartree-Fock energy as just this E0. When we do the transformations, some of the transformations involved add on to the E0. And so this E0 will drop down in energy. And if you do everything exactly, meaning keeping 3, 4 particle terms and do the diagonalization exactly, what you end up with is this Hartree-Fock energy drops down to be the exact ground state. And the energies that you have going up are the exact excitation energies. Okay. So how do you choose what theta to rotate by? Here's this angle theta. We're trying to imitate the Jacobi method. And so we want to use this formula that involves the inverse tangent. But the thing that is a little bit tricky is that we have an energy denominator which comes into the formula. To lowest order, theta is going to be the term A divided by an energy denominator, EI minus EJ. And these energies in a matrix, these are the diagonal elements, but when you consider operators instead of matrices, your operators actually connect many different matrix elements. So for instance, suppose we have a term C dagger 1, C 2. This will connect the states C dagger 2, 0. It will connect that to C dagger 1, 0. So this operator makes a connection between these two basis states. Okay, but it also makes a connection between C dagger 3, C dagger 2, 0, and C dagger 3, C dagger 1, 0. So this operator makes this connection, and it makes this connection. So when we work with the operator basis, we're actually working with an exponentially large number of pairs of states at the same time. Okay? And that gives the method a lot of power. Like it's in some ways more powerful than a Hilbert space method where you just look at one particular basis state, or you just focus on this. You're doing an operator and it connects lots of things at once. Okay, but it brings up the question, which states do you use to form the energy denominator to know how much to rotate it by? And the simple answer is, it's not exact, but the simple answer is to take the simplest state that is connected by this operator. So you would take this state and call that energy E right, and this state has an energy and you'd call it E left. And you would just take the energy of this state in sort of the diagonal part of the Hamiltonian. Okay, now over here we have an ER prime and an EL prime. Okay, we're going to ignore these and just choose these to define an energy denominator to know what to rotate. Now, the fact that we're doing this in an iterative fashion means that if any differences in these energies from the simplest term to these more complicated terms will eventually show up. So this is just to give a good approximate choice for an angle to rotate to do the canonical transformation or unitary transformation.
In fact, in the Jacobi method, if you would, instead of taking the exact formula for theta, take an approximation,
yeah. This
would converge too.
Right, right. It would hardly make a difference, except in cases where there is degeneracy.
You make a really bad choice, but if you take some approximation, it's good enough.
So, yeah.
So E is the average value of H in that state. Right?
Yes, exactly. Okay, so this allows us to work with operators but connect with perturbation formulas that are sort of based in terms of states. Okay, so then you apply this, so you've got the theta, you go through and you look for large terms to rotate away. You perform the rotation with this exponential formula, and you get new terms in the Hamiltonian, and you throw away higher order terms. That's the basic procedure, which I'm calling the Jacobi canonical diagonalization. Okay, let me show you the result for that. Okay, this is the water molecule again, same basis. And the x-axis now is the number of rotations I've done. Now each rotation is just with one many-body term. And there are n to the fourth of them that I could consider doing. But I'm starting with the largest, trying to get rid of the terms that contribute to the energy the most. So the top curve is the constant term in the Hamiltonian. So in this particle hole transform basis, there's just this constant term that starts out as the Hartree-Fock energy, and then the transformation keeps putting more and more into the constant term, and eventually it goes to a limiting value. The limiting value is not the exact result, and that's because we've thrown away all the three particle terms in doing this calculation, three and four particle terms. So that's the error. But you can see for this water molecule that it does extremely well. The error here is about 4 millihartrees, so roughly chemical accuracy. So this Jacobi method is able to just working on its own for this water molecule is able to get a highly accurate result. Okay, and then you can also improve the calculation by at each step. When you rotate away these large terms, you actually improve the convergence of other methods. So this perturbation theory is just the very simplest second order perturbation theory on this problem. And it starts out with a reasonably closer answer, but as you remove the large terms, it improves the convergence of the perturbation theory. And so you actually wouldn't have to carry out this calculation all the way as far as you see here, because if you just look at the perturbation theory, you can, it converges much more rapidly. Okay. Okay, now I've... Okay. Now, there's another variation of this method, which Franz Wegener talked about a few weeks ago here, where instead of doing these discrete unitary transformations, you write down a differential equation that when you solve this differential equation, it gives you a continuous unitary transformation. Okay, and since I'm a little short on time, let me just write down the differential equation. dH of t dt, I consider this a time-like variable, is a commutator of an a of t and an h of t. Okay, and so you just evolve this equation. These sorts of continuous unitary transformations have existed for 50 years, but in the past they've been done with a constant a. Okay, and what's nice about this flow equation method that Franz Wegener developed originally is that by making a of t variable and it's derived from h, then this flow equation will work much like the Jacobi CD method. It will just flow until the Hamiltonian is diagonal. Okay? So you get a flow in t until h is diagonal. Now, in order to do that, you have to make a of t, it depends on the matrix elements of h. You have to put in minus signs in order to make it anti-Hermitian, okay? And I guess I'll skip the details of constructing that, but essentially you take each term that you want to remove from the Hamiltonian, maybe you want to remove all of them, maybe not, and you put in minus signs for one of the two Hermitian conjugates, and you just use that to define a of t. Okay, and you get results, you get plots that look very similar to what I was just showing with the Jacobi method. Okay, so here is the this result of the flow equation with this parameter t, and again, it's looking at the constant term in the Hamiltonian, starts out at the Hartree-Fock value, and as you flow in t, it flows down towards the exact value. And it turns out that the error with this approach was something like a factor of 3 or 4 smaller than for the Jacobi method. So it's it at least in this case is a little bit more accurate. Okay, now what happens if you try to do something like this to a system with strong interactions? Something where the Hartree-Fock starting point is not so good. You get an interesting result. Okay, so here's this flow equation, but with the stretched water molecule. So the characteristic of the stretched water molecule is that the Hartree-Fock starting point is not very good. And what that means is that it has lots of low energy states. Those low energy states can get large energy denominators. This is also truncating all three particle terms. Now, if you keep 3 and 4 and arbitrarily many particle terms, it will always converge nicely to the exact result. It's an exact method without truncation. Okay, but if you only keep 2 particle terms, the method actually becomes unstable. It can get sort of an iteration involving a number of different terms which sort of feed on each other, and it can just blow up. So this method by itself isn't a good method for some of the harder problems. Okay, it's a good method for some of the easier sort of equilibrium geometry problems, and it's a good method to get rid of high energy orbitals, But when you try to do it with something that's in some way strongly correlated, it can just give you nonsense. Now, you can fix this in two different ways. One way is to keep three and more particle terms, and then you can get a nice convergence, and you can sort of do that, but it becomes computationally very time-consuming. But I have done that as a test case and got very accurate results keeping many particle terms. But I think a more promising approach is to use this as an input to DMRG. Okay. So, the approach I'll outline is that we have these orbitals, some Fermi level, and we're going to try to remove these and remove these, and we will just keep those orbitals that fall within a certain energy window of two Hartrees. Turns out that two Hartrees will give you a similar accuracy to what I just showed in the good case for the water molecule, around a milli-Hartree in accuracy, so it's quite nice. And then with this reduced Hamiltonian, you do DMRG, and you have an easier problem for DMRG, and it doesn't care about the strongly interacting part of the problem, and it just does it. Okay, so this is, so I view this as sort of a very nice RG type of approach of moving the high energy things, feeding it in to the low energy part of the Hamiltonian. Whenever you do an RG method, you have to have some tool to carry it out. RG is just sort of a framework. And so these unitary transformations are the tool that you use to do this. Okay, how do you throw away an orbital? My eraser go. Okay, we're removing off with this. These unitary transformations, we're removing off-diagonal parts of the Hamiltonian. So let's go back to this natural orbital occupation representation. And these are each of the orbitals. Okay, what we're going to try to do is take these orbitals and drive their occupancy to 2. To 2 exactly. Now, if the occupancy is 2 exactly, there's no fluctuations, and you can treat their occupancy as just a number, and it just remove it from the Hamiltonian. And over here, we're going to drive the occupancy to 0. Okay, how do you drive the occupancies to 2 or 0? What you do is you remove the off-diagonal couplings that connect these orbitals to the rest of the system. So so we have lots of terms, C dagger I, C dagger J, K, L, and we're going to, let me draw something like this. So these are the high energy orbitals, and here's the low energy orbitals. And any term in the Hamiltonian has a, so this is the energy. I'll draw a term by listing its left energy and the right energy. And so we have terms that look like this, E left and E right. Now it's these terms that, so here we have the space that involves occupancies of these, and they have Hamiltonian connections that induce this occupancy, and we're going to eliminate all of these terms that connect you into this space. Okay, and this space has rather high energies involved because we're only looking at energies far away from the Fermi surface, so far away from the strongly interacting region. So this we're going to drive to 0. Okay, and it turns out that There's a simple rule for characterizing those terms. If I is to be removed, then you remove, that means you, with the, either the Jacobi or the flow equation method, you do the transformations to remove it. We're going to remove any term with a di or a d dagger I, but not both. If it has both, then both endpoints are in the high energy region, and if it has neither, both are down here. And so if we just do the ones that have one, we break the connections between them. Okay, so so let me show you some results for that. So again, we have the water molecule, and we have n equals 25. And here I'll list the orbitals removed. This is how many are removed. Okay. And then here is the error in the energy. Okay, if you move 8 orbitals, you can get an error in the energy of 3 times 10 to the minus 4. 13 orbitals, you get something similar, 3 times 10 to the minus 4. It's not monotonic, so came out the same. Remove 17 orbitals, so 2/3 of them, you start to get a more significant error, 0.016. And so my goal is to get errors of order 10 to the minus 3. And so here's sort of the dividing line of where I might stop. But you can keep going, and you still get reasonable results. So this one was 0.014. And removing 21 gave 0.012. OK, so this is with this hybrid procedure where I remove the orbitals, and then on the resulting smaller system, I do DMRG. And the DMRG calculation is essentially exact, particularly because the resulting system is so small it becomes equivalent to an exact diagonalization. OK, so what you see from this is that we can remove roughly half of the orbitals in this sort of typical system and have a very small energy. When we try to remove more than that, we're getting a little bit close to the strongly interacting region, and we start to lose some accuracy. But in terms of doing larger systems, this seems to be the best approach. It's computationally somewhat more efficient to do the canonical transformations on a large system. And then eventually those stop working, and you have to switch over to DMRG. So this is sort of a hybrid approach. OK, so let me just summarize. So we have one, the DMRG method. So this can be used for these ab initio problems and works quite well for smaller systems. Eventually, it starts to get bogged down with the larger systems. There's also this what I call the canonical diagonalization approach, the unitary transformation approach, which works on the not strongly interacting part of a problem. So for some systems, you can solve the whole problem with this way. And in other systems, you can reduce the problem. And then we had this hybrid approach. And just once again, what I'd like to see is more work done on these canonical diagonalization approaches, these unitary transformations, in order to, for many strongly interacting systems, to have a more systematic way of deriving model Hamiltonians. You know, for instance, you could take the three-band Hubbard model, the copper-oxygen model, and eliminate the oxygens in exactly the way that I've shown here, and derive a one-band model, and you would get parameters from the transformations, and right now we don't know what those parameters are. And so it would be a very interesting approach to try. Okay, thanks.
You've been describing calculating the total energy, the ground state energy. Let's assume that we want to calculate some property like Green's function or two-particle excitation spectrum. It seems to me that you need to keep track of all the rotations you did.
Yes.
In order to...
That's right. You need to keep track of the rotation with the unitary transformations. You need to keep track of them in order to calculate all the properties involved. And we don't have much experience in just the practical matters for that. One of the nice things about the transformations is that it brings the Hamiltonian into more diagonal form. It doesn't just work on the ground state. It brings the whole Hamiltonian into a more diagonal form. And you can focus first on the ground state and try to get the exact result for the ground state by just eliminating the off-diagonal elements that connect to the ground state. But then you can go beyond that and consider excited states and diagonalize it more. In the end, if you carry this out exactly, which may or may not be feasible on a bigger system, but what you'll have is a non-interacting Hamiltonian where all the energies that are the true excitation energies, all the energies of this Hamiltonian. It's a diagonal Hamiltonian, so it doesn't have any off-diagonal terms. So it'd be a very nice form for getting excitation energies.
What if you have a continuum, like in the solid, you don't have these labels, you have bands. What happens?
Yeah, well, there you can break the connections as Wegener and others have shown. You can break the connections between the parts of the Hamiltonian having different numbers of quasi-particles. And then you have a simple diagonalization within those bands.
So your approach is a kind of clever way of doing CI calculation. There are different ways in quantum chemistry, not taking singles and doubles, but like the E to the S method. Did you
yes.
compare to the E to the
S? Yes. The couple cluster method. Despite my having trouble calling up the name, I've thought about that a lot. I just have trouble calling up all names every once in a while. But the couple cluster method is fairly close. The couple cluster method starts with, say, the Hartree-Fock Hamiltonian and writes an E to the A and gets a wave function that looks like this. Okay, and because of this exponential form, it builds in lots of contributions from many particle excitations all at once. And so it's a very nice method. And it's the energies that you get with this are reasonably comparable to the canonical diagonalization method alone. So for a nice problem, you can get comparable errors in energy. It has lots of problems when you have a harder problem with strongly interacting parts. And they've gotten somewhat bogged down in starting points which don't have just a single reference state. If you have some sort of many-body solution of a couple of orbitals and then try to do this, it turns out to be technically very challenging. And I think, so there's a lot of similarities, but I think this direction that I've gone where you start with the high energy orbitals and you reduce the system down and then finally do the low energy part of the problem. We know in solid state physics that that's the right way to go. That's the renormalization group way to go, is to start with the high energy things where you know how to handle things, and you work your way down and then you do the low energy part. The chemists have always before done the low energy part of the problem and then build in excitations to that. And in cases where the high energy part alters the low energy part, they would have trouble. So,
You just discussed two different parts of the system, so we should think differently, strongly correlated and the resonance. Is it possible to understand just physically which interactions, which parts of the effects should you treat as strongly correlated or not? What determines it?
Well, as a practical matter, it's easy to tell because you have this energy difference that I defined. It's approximate, but you have it, whenever this energy difference is small, from a practical point of view, you have to consider that to be strongly correlated. Now, it may be that even though the energy denominator is small for some particular state, it has no effect. Okay, but well, the other way of looking at it is in this sort of energy diagram, you're going to have this region here where both the left energy and the right energy are small, and this is clearly very strongly interacting. And so when you do the canonical transformations, the one thing you can't do and maintain accuracy is put both endpoints down here.
But the two high energy states, actually, at least what we learned from Hubbard model, actually, it's very difficult to separate high energy and low energy effects. There is always changes, transfer of spectral waves and so on, all these things. Is it concluded somehow? Is it contained?
Well, I don't agree that it's really difficult to separate the you have to do it carefully, but I don't think it's a really fundamental problem. These canonical transformations can do it exactly, and as long as you don't have small energy denominators, it will be exact. But certain things get built into the wave function, and if you're not paying attention to the fact that they're now built into the wave function, you may misinterpret the results. Okay, but it's not a fundamental problem.
Do you see ways of doing the strongly interacting Hubbard model to the other models, the combination of these approaches?
Well, we have simple methods for starting with the Hubbard model and getting the TJ model. And those are valid to, say, second order perturbation theory. And one could use one of these methods to do it to very high accuracy, not just to second order in T over U, but to depending on how many terms you kept, sort of whatever accuracy you wanted. You would get a lot more terms, and then the question will be, is it better to have something, a problem with only a few terms but high energy scales, or is it better to have something with lots of terms but they're all low energy? And so you have to constantly play that game and find some convenient stopping point. One could do it on the TJ model, and in the TJ model, of the energies that are left, the T term is high, the J term is typically smaller, and so you could try to remove some, at least reduce the level of T down to J. It would be, what you would be doing would be making quasi-particles that have excursions. If the hole is at some particular location, it would have excursions into the antiferromagnetic background built into it, and I think that would be a very interesting thing to try, but we don't know what the answer would be, whether it would be useful or not. Yeah.
Practical question. Is there a paper to refer to, or are you hanging those notes up on the web?
Yeah, there's a paper that appeared in the Condensed Matter Bulletin Board in something like February or March.
So the other case?
The Condensed Matter Bulletin Board, XXX, comment.
Yeah, the water molecule, you said, I mean, the plus minus two hatches, I mean, that's not what condensed matter, that they believe that's solved by density functional method or pseudo-potential method. So whatever.
Right. Right. So this is for high accuracy calculations that you're looking at. And of course, one would like to be able to reduce those levels down, so that you really had a much smaller number of orbitals to deal with. And so I was doing that here, reducing it down considerably. Now, I was looking at a total energy that was, by chemical standards, was getting a little bit far off. But by solid state standards, that might be fine. Or it may be that you need to consider a few three-particle terms in order to do that.
So
Yeah.
In the DMRG method, you really want short range interaction between the blocks, right? So that you can simplify things very easily. But if you go through this canonical dialization first, it's not clear that you may wind up with strong interaction with all the pairs, with all the possible pairs, and you have a very long range interaction as a result.
Right.
Would that be the case?
Well, this graph I showed in the middle of the talk was for this much harder problem with where once the starting point, the Hartree-Fock is off the graph. This is the energy after doing canonical diagonalization to get rid of a little bit more than half of the orbitals. And then the Hartree-Fock energies are not very good, but if you go to the natural orbitals, then it turns into a reasonable problem. And so, you know, DMRG is fairly flexible. It will work well because the interactions are local. It will also work well if the occupancies are near 2 or 0. So we can play on both.
In the crystal problem, many people in this workshop, we have been working on these so-called Wannier function-like orbitals, which are pretty localized in space. So yeah, you really have only strong interaction between maybe the nearest neighbor or the second nearest neighbor. But the problem is that no longer become eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. So you have some kind of density state or a spectral function associated with this orbital. What happens if we feed those orbitals in the canonical transformation first? And I would imagine that if we use this orbital directly to the DMRG, it would be ideal because you really have interaction between nearest neighbor. And multi-orbital on the same site.
Mm-hmm.
But if I go through this canonical analysis, it's likely that they are longer become, this orbital will become very different.
Well, they don't generate very long-range couplings immediately. So you can look at it through perturbation theory or the terms in the contract in the commutator expansion, and the lowest order terms will just be one. If it's nearest neighbor, it'll just be next nearest neighbor. And so you'll get some exponential tail. And then if you try to do it too far, it'll get long range. But certainly one could imagine a regime where you're willing to put up with next nearest neighbor interactions because it's solved part of the problem quite a bit.
Steve
Frantz
has a question.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you told us that when you first performed the canonical diagonalization, that then for states close to the Fermi edge, also three particle, four particle terms appear, and apparently they are important. But could you see that a certain structure for this interaction evolves? Or this would be somehow important to know, so that, let's say, one could perform certain approximations if one knows more about the structure.
Right. Well, what I had success with was to identify the small number of orbitals in these particular, in the water molecule, which had substantial partial occupancy, so they were strongly interacting. And when I do truncations of terms, I just don't count those C's and C daggers that involve those partially occupied orbitals. So you then could have very high excitations as long as it was just involved those few strongly interacting orbitals. That worked very well, but you might hope that you could find something that would narrowed it down further. And so I don't know how much better you can do. But so I just have specific knowledge about these particular systems, which just had a few orbitals which were strongly interacting. There you just had to brute force keep a lot of those terms involving those orbitals.
But you cannot say something about the structure of this interaction?
No. No.
If your system becomes really larger and larger, so what is the way to go? I mean, maybe really look something like dynamical field for small part. So how are you going to?
Yeah, how do you go to large systems? Even the Hartree-Fock, the starting point for this approach doesn't scale well with large systems. The Hartree-Fock part of the calculation scales as the number of orbitals to the fourth power. When you do the basis set transformation, that scales as n to the fifth. And the problem is that this is assuming that all of the orbitals are completely delocalized, so everything is interacting with everything else, and so you can get these four. Now, the way around that is if you have localized, if you want to do an extended system, you have to have localized.
Truncate interaction.
Yeah, you have to have localized orbitals. So if you think of DMRG as being the limit of localized orbitals, mm-hmm. That scales as n. And in these ab initios, it scales as roughly n cubed times the number of states cubed. The number of states is typically of order n, and so it's something like n cubed, n to the sixth. And so you have the scaling somewhere between n and n to the sixth. And it's a little bit hard to, really discuss the scaling when it depends so strongly on the nature of the problem that you're doing.
It's actually worse than n, right? Because you have n for the psi index, but you will have in the same psi multiple orbitals. So those are scale worse than n.
Let's see. The question is if everything's well, yeah, okay. So a Hubbard model or a Heisenberg model clearly scales as n.
Sure.
Okay. Then the question is, would a long-range Coulomb interaction mess up that scaling? And then it depends on how clever you are in dealing with the long-range Coulomb interaction, putting it into some sort of multi-scale form. It would be a lot of work with the long-range Coulomb interaction to bring it down all the way to n. Not so much work to make it n squared.
Okay.